For the last episode of season one of Corner of the Sky, it's only fitting that we tackle one of the biggest shows of all time, not only in terms of how long it's been on, but also its place in our cultural imagination, as well as the sheer spectacle, Les Miserables. Les Mis is truly an epic musical, based on a novel by Victor Hugo and set on the backdrop of a revolution in France. Les Mis, it follows the story of Jean Valjean, a man who is convicted to many, many years in prison for the simple crime of stealing bread for a starving child. The show opens as he is released from prison and is looking forward to starting a new life, but is perpetually hindered by his parole papers that make it impossible for him to find a job or even somewhere to stay. The rest of the show unfolds as Jean Valjean leaves his parole papers behind, creates a new identity, starts a business, adopts a child, and culminates in a central story, a group of young people struggling against oppression and fighting for what they believe in. I'm also really excited to have Elsa Shonison as my final guest for this season. Now, as usual, all spoilers are after the spoiler horn, and I hope you enjoy our conversation about Les Mis. I'm here today with Elsa Shonison, who you may have heard on one of the Incomparable's other shows, Pod for Ham, which if you haven't heard it, is an excellent show, by the way. And today we're going to be talking about Les Mis. So to start us off, Elsa, could you tell me why you wanted to talk about this musical? What does it mean to you?
So about 5 years ago, I got a hearing aid for the first time since I was a kid. And the first musical that I saw after getting my hearing aid was Les Mis. Now, to explain, I've been doing musical theater since I was probably 10 years old. And I've done Les Mis more than once. But it was the first time in my life that I heard the way that the musical patterns over itself. The way that different parts of the songs sound together. Because without a hearing aid, I could only listen to one thing at a time and focus. So I left the theater basically just sobbing. And a couple of my friends were like, well, it's Les Mis. I mean, you've seen it before. Why are you like this? And my reaction is because everything is so pretty.
Oh my gosh. That must be such an incredible experience of understanding something on one level and then being able to go and suddenly be understanding it on a whole other level.
It was really powerful, and I mean, it's something that is complicated because, deaf culture is about it being okay to be deaf, and that we don't need to hear in order to be good enough for everyone else. Mm-hmm. And so, like, on the one hand, I completely respect deaf people who choose to not wear hearing aids or to not get cochlear implants. But for me, it was a really powerful experience of a theater medium that I love deeply. And so it was a really life-changing moment for me. So I love talking about Les Mis whenever I can.
Well, we're going to have a whole lot of stuff to talk about with this musical today, so really glad you could be here for that. So you said you've been involved in musical theater since you were 10, and presumably you've been part of productions of the show as well?
Yes, I have.
So at what point in your life were you doing that, and what roles were you playing?
So I did that when I was in sort of the in-between period between high school and college. I played Fantine. And I did, I Dreamed a Dream, and it's one of those songs that I could probably still do off the top of my head, because you get one shot at it, and then you're dead.
I mean, that's one way to look at it.
It's certainly an option. But no, it's a great role to play, because you kind of have the opportunity to do this showstopper number, which not everybody gets to do, and I did it during summer camp. So it was pretty exciting. And then I actually have only done Les Mis once until I went and saw my friend's production.
And so when did you see your friend's production? Like,
that was 6 years ago now, because it was 20... No, it was 5 years ago, because it was right after I got married, I went back to Seattle to visit, and been married for 5 years, so that's how long ago it was. And that was a production by Balligan Theater in Seattle, Washington. And what was really neat about that production was that it was a really small theater, so you were really up close to the action in a way that if you see it on Broadway, you don't quite get the same experience. So during the barricade scenes, it was very much like you were on the barricade.
Yeah, Les Mis must be really interesting to see in a small theater because that is not a small show. Usually you have like very large, intimidating staging.
Yeah, I think I might actually prefer it as a small stage show now that I've seen it that way. Only because I think the experience of feeling like you're there and like you are part of the revolution is, that's a narrative that I really enjoy when I think about it that way. Interestingly, the set looked a lot, or at least it looked very similar to what I see as the Hamilton set. So it's like, oh, well, there's an interesting comparison to think about. Staging them relatively within a similar style, given that they both take place in a relatively similar time period.
Mm-hmm. With relatively similar subject matter, definitely different tones, but, you know, we've got revolutions going on. We've got little bro bands of revolutionaries.
I was joking when Les Mis and Hamilton were on Broadway at the same time, I was joking that whoever was playing Lafayette at the end of Act One in Hamilton should then run over next door because that's where he actually would have been.
Oh, I would have loved that. Just do a crossover day of both musicals.
Okay, and now Lafayette's going to hop 30 years later.
Which, I'm already getting distracted from my main topic, but did you see that Lin-Manuel Miranda did a brief guest spot in Les Mis on Broadway?
I did. I really appreciated that.
I just thought that was great. So back to Les Mis, though. And the staging and what you were saying about feeling like you were part of it, I think that is such an important part of what this show is. Because I was just re-listening to some of the music right before we got on this call, and I was actually watching one of the movie clips from Do You Hear the People Sing, and like it starts really quiet, and then they start getting up there, and I swear to God, I could feel my body being ready for revolution.
I listened to that song before I go to protests.
Oh, that's such a good idea. But that's really like, this show is so epic, and it is really covering this huge amount of ground and what it's talking about, but it still manages to pull you in, and it makes you feel like you can be part of this revolution, even if you're just watching it. And I think that's one of the most powerful things about Les Mis.
I think it's an important show in part because it is a show about activism. And I know a lot of people focus on the love story or the romance or the rivalry, but for me, that's what I love about Les Mis, is that it is a story about activism, it is a story about revolution, and in many ways it's about what you're willing to do and sacrifice for the better, for the better path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because this is, I wouldn't describe this as a happy musical. This isn't just some success story. This is definitely showing, you know, it's showing loss and death and struggle and the people who are willing to face all of that and who know they're going to face it and go anyway. So I think I want to back away from the death topic just a little bit. We never get too far away with Les Mis. We'll be back. But we were talking a little bit about the music, and specifically this contrast between Empty Chairs and Empty Tables and how it's a single voice and it's quieter and more intimate. But like you said, most of the music of the show, there's a lot of really dramatic themes. Honestly, dramatic is the best word for it, I think. It's a whole lot of choruses singing and interwoven voices, and people getting really, really excited about stuff. And not only that, it also has a lot of extremely iconic songs from theater canon.
Yes, that's very true. much of this music is stuff that you've probably heard, even if you haven't gone and seen Les Mis, even if you've never listened to the whole soundtrack, you've probably heard some of these songs before.
Mm-hmm. So some of the big ones are Do You Hear the People Sing?, I Dreamed a Dream, On My Own, the Red and Black song, Stars, One Day More, even Look Down. I feel like, also, a lot of these songs, I have to say, are kind of musical theater memes now, because they're so iconic.
It's true. It's one of those things where people, if you're around a group of people who listen to musical theater, there's a certain level of almost, some of these songs are jokes at this point. Like, if you say drink with me, somebody will start singing it. I'm not joking.
Oh, absolutely. I just, the number of times that I have just written out in a text message, Eponine voice, I love him.
In fact, I actually, I work for a science fiction magazine called Fireside Fiction Company, and last year, the day before we closed our submissions period, I rewrote One Day More to be about submitting to our magazine.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I'm a bad person. I did that to everybody else.
No, that's spectacular. I think One Day More might be my favorite Les Mis song, just because everybody's in it, and it's so dramatic and lovely.
I mean, this is what the opening of that particular section, which was, One day more, another day to get a sub to me. Submissions can't last an eternity. The stories that we read today, we'll have to choose which ones will stay one day more. And it goes on.
Did you rewrite the entire song?
Yes.
That's so many lyrics. Oh my gosh, I'm impressed with that. I think that was a beautiful achievement.
So, I mean, it's something that you can use as shorthand for things like this that almost everybody will recognize.
Mm-hmm. I think that for non-theater people, it's like hard for me to think in that perspective. But for like the general population, I even think songs like Do You Hear the People Sing is definitely going to be one that everyone knows, even if they've never. Yeah. I also think it's funny that there are a lot of songs musical, I feel like everyone knows three lines of the song, even if they have no idea how they learned it, but they don't know anything else.
I think that that's partially just how embedded it is in our current popular culture landscape. This isn't, you know, I mean, of movies that have been turned into musicals, there's very, very few that have been turned into musicals in the last 20 years. And the very few are Chicago and Les Miserables, and I can't actually think if there are any other ones. And everybody knows Chicago, and everybody knows Les Miserables.
The only other one I can think of off the top of my head is Mamma Mia.
That's true.
Mamma Mia and Les Mis are very different things, though.
I feel like Mamma Mia is a different category of musical, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the film adaptation of Les Mis was just ridiculously huge. I mean, in terms of production, and I'm pretty sure they did really well in the box office, but also just in terms of cultural impact.
It was massive. I mean, there's a moment when you see, and there's also some historical notes that you can find in that film. One of which is the Elephant of the Bastille, which they have in the movie, which was an actual historical thing. It was a monument in Paris which existed between 1813 and 1846. It was constructed by Napoleon, it was conceived by Napoleon. And it appears in the book, and then it's mentioned, but it's in the movie. They actually constructed, basically, the elephant under construction, specifically for Do You Hear the People Sing? Which is a massive undertaking, and really fascinating, as well as a really neat little touch for historians and musical fans alike.
I say this in the best possible way, because I love it. Les Mis is maybe one of the most extra movies I've ever seen.
It is really extra.
Oh, there's just all the things they did where they, like, they did all their singing live and they build these giant reconstructions of historical architecture and all of this stuff. And but it, like, it's a great movie. I mean, I haven't actually asked you what you personally think of the movie. I really like it.
I liked parts of it. I mean, I don't know. There were some singing issues.
Oh yeah, there were some questionable casting decisions and some questionable sound decisions.
There were some questionable decisions made about who could sing live and who could not. So that is what I will say, and be really politic about it.
I'm just gonna say that I feel like with this movie and with a lot of other movie musicals, when you cast theater people, it tends to go well. And when you cast non-theater people, it's a lot more iffy. Just saying.
Make better choices is what we're trying to get at.
I like how we're basically subtweeting Hollywood producers right now as if they personally listen to this show.
Well, you know, you never know who's bored driving around in LA. I mean, the traffic's terrible.
Oh, yeah. So, if anyone's out there, just saying. We're just gonna put that out there. On the topic of the movie, though, do you think that, like, movies like this are good for theater in general? Do you think that they bring more people to the actual theater, or does it stop at the movies?
I think they're great for theater, and part of why is that I think it's important to bring... I think a lot of people look at musicals and they say, oh, that's not cool. I think we're having a resurgence of that now. Less, like, more people are excited about musicals now, I think in part because of Hamilton. But I think movies like this do two things. One, they get musical theater people excited about seeing grander scale musicals. And two, they bring musical theater to people who can't necessarily go and see musicals. Because this is why I would love to see National Theater Live of musical theater. Because there's a lot of people who can't afford to go and see a musical on Broadway. Or maybe the musical you want to see isn't coming to your hometown. So I think that any time that we can bring more theater and more and different ways to experience theater of all kinds to wider audiences, we're better supporting the theater arts.
I want you to know that I would have been really aggressively snapping during all of that, but I didn't want to mess up my sound recording. I totally agree with you, though. I think that the possibility of especially having, like, live broadcasts of musicals would really be the future of bringing people in to Broadway and musical theater in general. Because, like, last year they had a live performance of She Loves Me that was broadcast nationwide, and that was so cool, and I want them to do that for all of the shows.
P.S. They're doing Newsies.
Yes, and they did a recording of Falsettos, I think, that's going to be in theaters in some places.
Falsettos was a really interesting show. We're not talking about that show right now, but it's a really interesting show.
Maybe next season we can talk about Falsettos. I got so distracted from my original point thinking about Broadway recordings, because it's, like, all I want in life.
I mean, I think it's important because we live in a time where, you know, media is accessible because of the internet, because of what kind of technology we have. But I don't want people to forget that, like, live theater is awesome and there are ways to support it that include technology.
Absolutely. And I do like that we're seeing a push towards that more and more, whether it be, like, these various live recordings or even, like, these live television musicals they've been doing, like Grease Live and Hairspray Live and all of those.
I have concerns about those in a lot of ways because it's not the original production. And what I mean by that is that it's not theater people doing them. Like, you can see the influence of theater people on the Les Miserables movie. You can see it because of the way that they handle the the material. I feel like if you're doing musicals on television, you're having to bow to a lot of pressures from production people or what the network stands for, and that certainly showed in Rocky Horror, because Rocky Horror felt like it was a straight version of a gay musical.
Ooh. Yeah, I didn't see that one.
Don't recommend. But basically, I felt like there was a lot stripped out of it because it wasn't being done by people who love musical theater.
Yeah. That is an issue. I personally, my favorite one that they've done is Grease Live. I really, really like Grease Live. Partially because I really love Aaron Tveit just so much. And I think that one was done well, and then there are others like Rocky Horror that's not really done as well. But I do think that the success of these kinds of shows are a positive versus them like not existing at all.
I think it's also tricky because different shows are basically, some shows would simply not do well on a live scale for television. Like doing Les Miserables live on Fox would be a massive undertaking that could never happen.
Just thinking about that is hilarious.
Just thinking about that makes my head hurt.
I mean, it was hard enough for them to do the movie. I can't even imagine trying to do a live television performance like that.
No, and I mean, that's kind of the thing. Like, when you've worked in theater for a long time, there are certain things that you learn. And one of the things that you learn is when a show is not fit for one medium or another. Les Miserables works as a movie because it is a giant, grandiose, multi-setting thing. It works on stage because on stage you can do big, grandiose things, or you can adapt it to do smaller things, like the production that I talked about. But I think putting it on a small screen would be challenging because you would lose a lot of the grandiosity.
First of all, grandiosity is a really great word, and it also perfectly describes Les Mis. But yeah, you're so right. I think that's something that you see in the movie and film. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that's something you see in the film and television industries that is sometimes ignored in favor of the bottom line. I feel like there are a lot of times you see adaptations of other mediums, and you're like, that probably shouldn't have been what you made it. It just was never going to work no matter what. I just wanted to take a minute, though, and talk about other forms that of this musical being performed, because I don't know, did you see the 25th anniversary edition?
I didn't.
Okay, so this was actually my first exposure to Les Mis. My mom showed it to me, and I was like, what is this? And she was like, just watch, it'll be fine. And so it's this giant televised production that came out of London for the 25th anniversary, and it was performed, I think they were in costume, but it didn't have staging, yeah.
Yeah. I have seen the concert version. I always just think of it as the concert production.
Oh, yeah, okay. But yeah, so they didn't have the same staging as the show, but they just had, like, a line of microphones in the front, so people would come out and sing their parts instead of just acting them out directly. And this version in particular is notable. One, most of it is very, very good. I'm kind of biased because it was, again, my first exposure to the musical, but I've always really liked it. But two, it's also the infamous Nick Jonas production, which is interesting on so many levels.
I think it's also interesting because Les Mis can be stripped down to do a concert version. I think the problem is when you go in between, either stripped down just to the singing, or this is everything. I think if you try to go in the middle, that's when you have a problem.
Yeah, I think concert versions of musicals, it doesn't work for every show, but in general, I could see that working in a cool way for a lot of things, especially for musicals that are entirely or primarily sung through, because it's just a different form of expression for it. But yeah, there's definitely a middle ground that isn't going to work for a significant number of shows.
Well, I think it's also the fact that it depends on how well known the musical is. If your musical is super well known and everybody can follow along, then you can do a concert version no problem. If it's a show that nobody knows, it's going to be a lot harder to get the audience to sort of engage and understand what's happening from purely a sung level. Without any kind of interaction or staging, it's difficult to convey story unless if people understand the story already in place.
That's really funny in reference to Les Mis, because there's a certain extent to which if you don't know the story, any version of Les Mis is difficult to follow because it is all sung through. And I tease this as an example for this. So I saw this concert version and my mom, who already knew the story, I think like explained some stuff to me if I wasn't following something, and that was fine. And a year or two after that, for a class trip at my high school, all the kids in the band went down to Boston to see the like official U.S. tour of Les Mis. And so I was really excited, and I was watching the show and everything. And then we got to the act break, and my two friends that were sitting with me were like, "What is happening?" They had followed nothing. And so since I already knew the story, I sat there and I explained what had happened in the first act and what was going to happen in the second act. And at the end, they were like, "Oh, that was really good," once I figured out what was happening.
Fair.
So yeah, Les Mis is... And I think the problem was that we were 15, not that it is a super difficult show, but there is a certain level of difficulty.
Sure. I mean, I think it's also just whatever mood you're in.
What do you mean by that?
Sometimes it's more challenging to focus on a thing when you're excited. Or maybe you're having a hard day and you can't quite focus on the show. Sometimes it's just you're having a day when watching a musical isn't something that you're actually as prepared for as you might think. I've certainly gone to see shows that are perfectly straightforward and then had no idea what was happening because of external whatever.
That kind of sounds like me in class sometimes. So I can't believe we've been talking for so long and haven't talked about any of the characters, really. But I do want to spend some time talking about them because although the show, like, it's got big themes, revolution, love, sacrifice. It also follows, like, a decent cast of characters around that you become very attached to, and then they all die, and that's less fun. But so let's just get into that, I guess, like, the revolutionaries in this show, which, disclaimer, I don't speak French. I don't know if I can say any of their names.
I do speak French, so...
Oh, well, then... You might have to take the lead on the name pronunciation front here. But in Les Mis, we have this band of revolutionaries, and...
Oh, well, there's Garrosh and Enjolras and Marius, and then you have Grantaire and Combeferre and Fury, and a whole bunch of other ones who are sort of in the background. And, of course, you also have Eponine, who wants to be a revolutionary.
Yes. First of all, while I was thinking about how to pronounce these characters, I just Googled that, and there's a SoundCloud file of a 30-second-long clip of how to pronounce the names of Les Mis characters, which is hilarious. I'm not the only one with this problem. But, yeah, and so we have and Rojas is, like, the leader of this crew, and then Marius, who... is one of the main characters of the show, and so he's really a central character of the revolutionaries, but also he's not quite on the same page as them because he decides that he is in love.
Yeah, he looks at the revolution and he looks at a girl and he picks the girl, which is fine.
I mean, it wasn't necessarily the wrong decision, but it is an extremely interesting juxtaposition.
It's a choice, with a capital C.
He doesn't necessarily just choose her straight off the bat, though. Like, he comes in, he says he's in love, he's struggling with this decision, but he does choose to come and fight with his friends.
You know, what I think is interesting about his arc is that he ends up being the person who actually gains the most, I would say, in this show. Like, he experiences an enormous amount of loss, but in the end, I think he really is the person who kind of, he has the least to lose at the beginning, if that makes sense, but he has the most to lose by the end of the show. Which isn't usually how character arcs go.
I mean, it's hard for him not to be the person who has the most to lose at the end, as he is one of the only people left alive.
I wasn't gonna say that, but yeah. He has the most to lose at the end because he's already lost everybody else and now he's only got so much.
Yeah, it's hard not to be the winner, because that's a really horrible way to say it, but like the person who ends up with the most, if you are one of only like two surviving characters.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I would say is actually it's interesting thinking about other media that has looked at Revolution recently, and I would say that one of the best sort of comparisons I can make in terms of talking about sacrifice and characters who end up with the most to lose at the end, you also might want to look at Rogue One, which is a Star Wars movie and talks about Revolution and also ends with, well, spoiler warning, a whole lot of people dying. And I think that it's a mark of a good show about Revolution when you find yourself actually experiencing grief along with your characters.
Mm-hmm. I feel like whenever any forms of media try to tackle these conversations of revolution and war and don't actually like present the grief and the sacrifice that goes into that, it's so deeply unsatisfying because you know that they just weren't brave enough to do that.
It was interesting because there's, you know, Hamilton is also about revolution, and there's less strongly felt loss in the same way, except if you go and see the show, there is a song in which Hamilton finds out that someone is dead, and it's not on the CD.
Yeah, I haven't seen Hamilton on stage yet, she said, hopefully, but I have heard about this scene, and like, I'm excited to experience it firsthand.
And I think that's one of the things that's important here, is that all of these pieces of media that deal with revolution, what they have in common is that they make their audience feel loss. They do it in different ways. But, I mean, in Les Miserables, it's the song Empty Chairs at Empty Tables.
Yeah, I feel like that's really the reckoning song of this show, because you have all of these beats of character deaths really just throughout, but it keeps going. And then at the end, you have this moment where we just stop and cry all together for a while.
And because it's a solo, and so much of this show is about weaving voices together, instead of just one person singing, when you have Marius walk in and do this very bleak song about people being dead, it contrasts with everything else that you've heard. And it's a wall of sound. I mean, you finish with One Day More at the end of Act One, and then you pick up with the barricade at the top of Act Two, and it's basically a wall of sound. A Little Fall of Rain is quieter, but it's still not, it's not the bleak solo. There is nothing else happening in this song except for him being really sad.
It doesn't give you anything to distract you. You just have to be there with him.
Which makes it really effective. And that's what's effective about the scene in Hamilton, and that's what's effective about the very end of Rogue One, is that all of those things make you sit with the uncomfortable knowledge that people are dead.
So kind of the central character of the show is Jean Valjean. And so the musical starts with him and it ends with him, and it doesn't stay on him the whole time, but like you kind of get this thread throughout his life as he interacts with different groups of people. And he's just like one of the most mistreated characters in musicals. Because this poor guy, he goes to jail for so long. All he did was steal some bread. And then he has a police officer chasing him around for the rest of his life. As he's just trying to raise a daughter and be a good person.
Let's be real here. Javert is a police officer who is a little too committed to his job. I'm not entirely sure what he does in his free time, because he doesn't have any free time, because he's too busy chasing after someone who he refuses to use the name of. Like, what is going on with him? Well, actually, what's going on with him is that Javert is a stubborn, bored person.
His hobby is justice.
His hobby is justice. Kind of. I'm not sure if I would call Javert a just person. I would call Javert a lawful person.
Ooh, yes. That's an important distinction. He is a complicated character, and I know there's, like, various discourse over, like, is he the villain of the show or not? I, in some ways, almost struggle to consider him a character. I almost think of him more of a symbol of, like, the oppression of France against these common people.
He is. Well, he's in many ways, we hear about the unjust things that are happening in France. We hear about what it's like to be poor. We witness what it's like to be poor. In the beginning of the show, we witness Fantine experiencing sexual harassment on the job. But aside from that scene, the Thénardiers, who we'll get to in a minute, and Javert, we don't have the overarching evil, if you know what I mean. Like, the oppressors or the ones who are wielding tyranny, none of them are just there. They're sort of the abstract concept of what everyone is fighting against. So Javert, in many ways, you're right, he's a stand-in for everything else that's happening that we don't see.
That way of looking at him also makes it more complicated to think about this character's end, because Javert ends up committing suicide in the second act after he's unable to reconcile this idea of Jean Valjean as a criminal and also a good man.
I mean, I think that's it's complicated, right? Because on the one hand, Javert is exactly that. He is the character who, you know, stands in for badness. On the other hand, by the end, you're right, he's a complicated character, and he's complicating his own narrative. It's not so much that other people complicate it for him, it's that he goes off on his own quest to find Jean Valjean, goes over to the other side undercover, and that's when he finds out that, like, things are different than what he assumed. So he complicates his own personal internal narrative instead of somebody else doing it for him, which I think is an interesting choice for the authors to have made. Ultimately, though, I think it is the difference between him being just or being lawful that is the reason why he commits suicide. Because he has followed the path of being lawful and very strongly clinging to the law, and when he begins to want to be a just person, I think that's when he can't see the justness in himself.
Wait, so on that idea of he can't see the justness in himself, like, do you think that, like, if he was, like, a different person or a different character, and he had been able, as you say, to see that in himself, like, do you think that would have ended him with him, like, joining the revolution? Or do you see that there any way for this character to go?
I mean, I think if he had made different life choices in Act 1, he may not have committed suicide in Act 2. But I also, you know, I can't change the script based on, you know what I mean? Like, it's hard to see what the thread would have been. Maybe Javert could have joined the revolution if it were written differently, but I don't know. I don't know. I guess that's sort of the honest answer. As a writer, I don't know, because I can't rewrite the script for them.
Yeah, of course. It's a good exercise to think about, like, the ways that stories can end differently, partially just because it's an interesting thing to apply to thinking about a musical or any other work of art, but also because I feel like these stories exist to teach us lessons about our own life. And so being able to think through like characters like Javert and like what actually happened here and what could have been different, even though we'll never know, I think is a good way to be able to think about how it could possibly apply to your own life.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the difficulty for Javert is that he looks back at the life choices that he's made, and specifically the judgments that he's made on other people, and the experience of being so black and white about choices other people make, that he ultimately finds himself in a place where he doesn't see a way to reconcile. And I think that's what makes things, I think that's what ultimately brings him to such a crisis.
Javert is the ultimate consequence of cognitive dissonance.
I mean, he literally says, you know, damned if I'll live in the debt of a thief, damned if I'll yield at the end of the chase. I am the law, and the law is not mocked. Like, he identifies himself as the law so hard that if, when he begins to change his mind about a person who he sees so much in a defiance of the law, that I think it becomes difficult for him to accept. It's too difficult for him to accept that his world has changed.
It's a bit of a grim picture.
I mean, welcome to Les Mis.
Like, there's truth in advertising with this show.
It's not a happy musical. And I just quoted another musical while I did that.
Oh, wait, which one?
You're in Town.
I don't know that one.
You're in Town is the height of exposition and breaking the fourth wall completely until it dies. You're in Town has a character named Little Sally, and Little Sally says, why, Kim asks Officer Lockstock, can't we do a happy musical next time? And he says, well, this isn't a happy musical, and her response is basically, but the music's so happy. And I feel like this absolutely applies to Les Mis. The musical is beautiful, music is beautiful and gorgeous and stirring, and yeah, this is a really depressing show.
It's just a one-stop shop. Like, you've got your songs to go to protest and like perform a revolution, and then you got your songs just make you sad forever. And there's not really an in-between.
No, I mean, you know, you listen to empty chairs at empty tables, you have feelings. You listen to stars, you have feelings. You listen to On My Own, you also have feelings. Different feelings.
I love the song On My Own so much that, like, anytime anyone ever says that phrase, like just now, my brain just starts singing the song. Also, before we wrap up, just want to take a couple minutes to talk about Eponine because I love Eponine. She's one of my favorite characters in all of musicals, and I mean that's like she's very popular fan favorite overall. But and then I said this in the Phantom of the Opera episode, but she belongs in canon of best friends who have got it better together than the Lita.
I mean, part of what I like about Eponine is that almost if you've been a teenage girl for any point in your life, at any point in your life, you identify with Eponine. I'm not sure that there's a better way to put it. Everybody has had their Eponine moment.
Luckily, most of those did not result in death, but like it sometimes feels like that.
And I think that's actually what it is that even if you are, even if your experience is that it's not, you're not actually going to die, everybody has that moment of heartache, that moment of this person, I really like them, and they do not like me back, and I am sad. Most of us do not turn around from that particular feeling and go, so I'm going to go do something really dangerous and die.
Yeah, if that's a really bad extreme outcome for the situation, which hopefully serves as a, good lesson for people. But I was watching the Oscar performance of One Day More the other day, because all I do now is watch Les Mis clips on YouTube as soon as I knew we were doing this episode. But and the staging of the Eponine Cosette Marius part is, Cosette and Marius are like standing facing each other, singing about how much they love each other, and Eponine is standing right behind them, staring at the audience, just being sad. And I'm like, this is the most heartbreaking staging.
Ouch. Saddest of faces, that is Eponine's job.
Eponine deserved better.
She did.
But she did win the position of one of musical theater's all-time fan favorites, so that's like a pretty good place for her.
And also, she, you know, she is a revolutionary. There are no women revolutionaries in this show in the way of, like, up on the barricade, but Eponine is the one who I feel has the strongest I am a revolutionary moment.
Absolutely. I mean, she gets up there, she makes the ultimate sacrifice, and then the people on the barricade really use her death as a rallying cry for the rest of their fight.
So even though she is not the leader of the revolution, she does take part in, and ultimately aids the revolution quite strongly.
So I guess in that way, she did get, even though she never got Marius, she did get to fulfill one of her goals.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's totally fun to talk about this musical and everything, but it's also, like, so hard not to just get depressed thinking about it.
Happy-sounding musicals with deeply depressing endings.
I want that to be the name of a production company.
Yeah, it probably already is. Somewhere. Somewhere someone is using that tagline. Don't sue me.
TM, 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 TM. Okay, I think that's about all I have. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about before I transition to the lightning round?
The only thing I would say is I did say I would talk about the Thénardiers. And I mean, in terms of mustache-twisty villains, it doesn't get much more mustache-twisty and terrible than the Thénardiers. I mean, I frankly feel like they belong in a Roald Dahl book. These are people who are so horrifying that when they discover people who are dying in the sewers, they try and charge them for help. These are people who will take advantage of anything and everything to get what they want. These are not good people. These are your villains. Javert is a villain who has complicated morality toward the end of the show. The Thénardiers have zero remorse throughout the entire production. They are just bad people, and they are fine with that. Which I think is interesting in a show that really does operate in shades of gray. There is one pair of people who operate in zero shades of gray.
Yeah, the show really makes zero attempt to complicate them in any way. They are loud, they are fun, they are evil.
Yep.
They do have one of the most... I don't want to say best, because there's some, like, works of art music in this show. But one of the most fun songs, and maybe one of the ones I listen to the most, Master of the House.
I really don't like that song, but I can see why people would.
Oh, really? Why don't you like it?
Honestly, I just find it irritating.
Ooh.
Like, I have no reason to dislike it, except that I just find... I find the repetitiveness of it really irritating.
Oh no, that's fair. I personally think it's a fun song to, like, clean to.
Oh sure, it's absolutely a fun song. I just don't choose to listen to it unless if I'm doing a full, you know, listen through.
Yeah. But I guess when you have a show that has this as many characters as Les Mis does, you can always throw in your, as you put it, mustache-twisty villains.
Mustache-twisty villains.
Okay, are you ready for the lightning round?
Sure.
Favorite song?
My favorite song is One Day More.
Classic. Your favorite line?
My favorite line is from Do You Hear the People Sing? And it is, when the beating of your heart echoes the beating of the drums, there is a life about to start when tomorrow comes.
Yes. Favorite character?
I'm going to have to go with Eponine.
Who specifically would you recommend go see this musical?
Anybody who is interested in getting involved in any kind of activism, this really will, it will make you feel something about being in an activist movement. Especially, you know, you don't want to think about it as like, everybody I know is gonna die, but it will make you feel like, yes, I'm ready to stand on the barricade.
Yes, please. One half, not the other. We'll all be good. And finally, if you could combine this show with any other musical, which one would you pick and why?
You know, the other musical that I was considering doing for this was The Last 5 Years, because it's a narrative, it's a really interesting show from a narrative perspective. It's another show I've done, but it's beautifully crafted in a way that I think is really interesting to talk about.
All right, cool. Well, then that is all I have for today. Thank you so much for joining me and talking about some Les Mis.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening. Goodbye. Thank you for listening to the season finale of Corner of the Sky. We're going to be going on hiatus now, with our return date to be announced later. So this is where you come in. If you like, you can follow us on Twitter at @COTSPodcast, where we will be continuing to tweet about musical theater news. And if there is anyone you'd like to see on this show, or especially any musicals that you'd like us to talk about, send us a tweet, let us know. You can also find us at theincomparable.com/COTS, or in Apple Podcasts, where it would be cool if you left us a review. If you leave us a review, I will love you as much as Cosette loves Marius, and almost as much as Enrojas loves Revolution. But seriously, thank you for listening to season 1, and I'll see you all in a few months. Goodbye!